world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ore Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. Supply chain disruptions just never seem to end. From the pandemic to the war in Ukraine, and most recently, a collapsed bridge in Baltimore that has put one of America's biggest ports out of action. How can businesses shore up against the costs? And would you eat from a stew that's been bubbling away for months? Yeah, see, I was skeptical too, but it's a thing. Perpetual stew is very much a thing and becoming increasingly popular, especially with young people. But first.
On this vote, the ayes are 311 and the nays are 112. The bill is passed. Oh, one voting present. I missed it, but thank you.
There was celebration in Congress this weekend. It accepted President Joe Biden's pitch to spend $100 billion on aid for America's allies under threat, Israel, Taiwan, and especially Ukraine.
Сьогодні ми отримали рішення, якого очікували, про пакет американської підтримки, за яке так ми боролися.
Today we have got the decision we were waiting for, said Volodymyr Zelensky, Ukraine's leader. It is a package that will be felt by our soldiers on the front lines and in our cities and villages that suffer from Russian terror. The bill had languished in Congress for 6 months since it was proposed last October. The dithering had consequences. Ukrainian soldiers forced to ration ammunition are being pummeled by Russians with an artillery advantage of 5-1. America's senior general in Europe warned that Ukrainians could lose on the battlefield by the end of 2024. So what difference does $61 billion, Ukraine's share of the aid deal, make to an army?
This is $61 billion of desperately needed aid for Ukraine.
Shashank Joshi is The Economist's defense editor.
And it should have an almost instant effect on the battlefield within weeks, probably, in fact, within days.
Why is this aid so urgently needed? I mean, how have the Ukrainians been faring recently?
Ukraine has really been struggling on the battlefield, Oris. I think we've said on the show many times. They've been running short of ammunition, in particular shells fired from artillery, but also air defense interceptors. Russia has been slowly making progress in the east of the country. And I think there was mounting concern that actually there was a realistic possibility of a Ukrainian collapse on the battlefield over the summer months, if nothing changed, if no American aid package arrived. The supplies haven't arrived yet. This will all need to go through the Senate. It will need to be signed by President Joe Biden. But once the ink is dry, and all of this will almost certainly come through, given that we know there's support in the Senate, and of course the White House supports this, then this is great news, because what it means is Ukraine, even from now, no longer needs to ration ammunition quite as jealously as it will have been doing really over the past 6 months.
Shashank, where will the money go?
Some of the money is going to go to funding immediate shipments to Ukraine and paying for the Pentagon to replenish those stocks for itself. And some of the money will go to American arms manufacturers to make new ammunition and weapons. There's quite a lot of money, you know, $26 million, for example, for oversight and accountability of that aid, which is something that is really important to Republicans who feel that the aid was being misused. But basically, we're talking here about two critical things. We're talking about shells, which are desperately needed. And we're talking about air defense interceptors to try to make sure Ukrainian launchers can shoot Russian planes and drones out of the sky. The sense is that America has some of these things pre-prepared in Europe. They'll be ready to launch off the runway the second Joe Biden signs this bill. And overall, I think this should be sufficient ammunition to last Ukraine for about a year or so. Now, that's not incredible. It's not going to fund a 5-year conflict, but it will get Ukraine through the tumult of this year of Russia's rearmament, of an American election, of elections in Europe. It will tide Ukraine over to that point. Bigger weapon systems are going to take a bit longer. For example, anti-missile batteries, anti-aircraft batteries, these will take a little bit of time to build. There are some in Europe that people are trying to get to Ukraine, but overall, not everything's going to be there in week one. It's going to take a little bit of time. And this matters because if you talk to Ukrainian intelligence officials, they say Russian ground forces are expected to make a pretty big push next month, and Ukraine needs everything it can get.
But this bill is still a big blow to Putin's plans, right?
I think this will be a huge blow to Putin's plans. He will have hoped that by ramping up defence spending to more than 6% of GDP, maybe more than 7%, by spending 30% of his budget on defence spending, that he was projecting this image, his economy, his war machine was an unstoppable juggernaut, and that by smashing up Ukraine's critical infrastructure, its power grid with missiles, by slowly gaining ground in the east, he was presenting this narrative that Ukraine was defeated, Russia was on the unstoppable march, that European countries, America, may as well give up now. And I think the fact that Donald Trump also approved this bill, in part because he got a concession that it would be described as a loan, which is something of a little party trick, that shows Putin that there is still a degree of long-term support in America for Ukraine. I think that's really important. And I think what it does is cast an element of doubt in Russia's mind that time is on its side, because we know Russia also has its own problems. We know that it's only got enough Soviet-era armored vehicles and tanks to last for another couple of years. We know that it will potentially run out of artillery barrels next year. We know that it will face shortages in things like explosives that go into ammunition for rockets. And so all of those factors may begin to bite over the course of the next 18 months. And if Russia had its optimal advantage now that it hoped to drive home against a defenseless Ukraine, I think that this resets the clock. It doesn't fix everything. Donald Trump could still become president. This could still be the very last American supplemental that Ukraine enjoys. There may be other issues, but this has bought desperately needed time for Ukraine. And what that means is Putin can no longer be so cocky. He can no longer be so confident.
Well, it sounds like Ukraine is still very much in this war, for now at least.
Ukraine is absolutely in this war. It can hold the line. Western defense budgets are rising. Western arms factories are working double time. And I think that it's important to understand that although Ukraine is still on the back foot, it will not have the advantage in artillery just yet. It's still going to be at a disadvantage. I think the risk of a Russian breakthrough, the risk of a Ukrainian collapse, that has significantly receded this week. However, that is not the same as saying that Ukraine now suddenly has a credible counteroffensive option. Many of the same problems that bedeviled its counteroffensive last summer, that made that offensive a failure, those factors are still in place. For example, the lack of training, that's a huge problem. So I still think in the longer run, we have a kind of difficult problem to solve, which is to say, if the front lines are relatively static, if neither Russia nor Ukraine can win, we're going to see renewed pressure to say, why not look for a settlement? Why not have talks? To which the Ukrainians will say, we don't trust anything Putin says, we don't want to have any talks right now, and we want to keep fighting, so keep arming us. But I think that debate is going to keep ticking on. The calamity has been averted this weekend, but given what could happen in November and the elections, no one can be sure of what happens in the future.
But for now, this is great news for Ukraine.
It's great news for Ukraine. The really important thing is that it isn't just for Ukraine. If you look at the supplementals passed by the House on that dramatic night, it wasn't just the Ukraine supplemental with $60 billion. It was one for Israel, which included about $26 billion. things to replenish its missile defense systems, for example, and send it more artillery and weapons. And I think people may easily forget Asia still has problems. And there was a separate Indo-Pacific security supplemental, which was $8 billion. That's $3 billion for submarines. Good news for the AUKUS submarine deal. It was $2 billion plus for Taiwan. And so when I look at these bills all together, I think the message here is not just that Ukraine is safe. The message is America is back. America is standing by its allies. And there's a message that's going out, which is that for all the talk of a resurgent China, of Iran running amok in the Middle East, of Russia resurgent, really, American leadership is still this critical force in global politics today. And this money really underscores that.
Shashank, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you haven't already, you should catch up on the latest episode of The Weekend Intelligence. Our correspondent, Andrew Miller, has been to meet Robert Kennedy Jr. It's a wide-ranging interview looking at a life inside America's most famous political family and why Mr. Kennedy is running for president as an independent.
I saw things happening to my party and to my country that made me frightened about the world that my children are going to grow up in. And, the Democratic Party has become the party of war. It's become the party of corporate control. It's become the party of censorship. I felt like I was in a unique position to be able to talk to the American people and remind them about what this country is supposed to look like.
The Weekend Intelligence is available to subscribers of Economist Podcast Plus. Click on the link in the show notes to find out more.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Our incredibly well-connected world relies on the far-reaching networks that make up the global supply chain. It lets materials, parts, and products be made and sent all over the world. But that supply chain is vulnerable to global forces, whether they be natural disasters or man-made. And there really have been a lot of disruptions recently.
That bridge collapse is also disrupting transportation and shipping. The Port of Baltimore is the 9th busiest for foreign cargo in the U.S. and the
shipping companies are bracing for weeks of disruption to their normal routes after several of them announced they would avoid passing through the Red Sea. This follows multiple attacks on shipping by Yemen-based Houthi rebels.
Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company and its closest rivals have evacuated factory areas after the biggest earthquake hit the country in 25 years.
In recent years, supply chain managers have really had their work cut out for them.
Anjani Trivedi is The Economist's global business correspondent.
The Baltimore Bridge closed one of the world's major ports. The Taiwan earthquake has put the production of semiconductors under risk. The Houthi attacks, America's trade war with China, the war in Ukraine and in Gaza have all had an impact, not to mention the pandemic. All these issues are a reminder to the industry that it's better to stockpile and be safe than sorry. But that can be expensive and comes with trade-offs.
So how can businesses shore up against supply chain disruption?
There are two ways. There's either the just-in-case way of production, which makes networks shock-proof, not the just-in-time, which is the uber-efficient production method. The simplest way is bigger buffers for companies for their raw materials and their finished products. But boosting inventories costs a lot, and the price is rising because of higher interest rates. JP Morgan calculates that by the end of 2022, companies that make up the S&P 1500 index of America's biggest companies had more than $600 billion trapped in working capital. Basically, the value of a business's inventories plus what they owe to their customers minus what they owe to suppliers. And that was about two-fifths higher than before the pandemic. And estimates show that it may have risen further. So it's no wonder that companies are trying to use those dollars instead in pursuit of profits. Success comes down to what kind of company you are. Do you make or sell? What do you make and what do you sell?
In what way?
So American business inventories are as large as they were on the eve of the pandemic relative to their sales. That's a measure of how well companies can manage their stocks. Now, in different parts of the supply chain, stockpiles had been getting larger for decades prior to the pandemic, despite the push by companies to be uber efficient, to carry less stock and less raw material. But that broader trend conceals a divergence. Retailers that sell goods, not manufacture them, their inventory to sales, which is, as I said, a measure of how well companies manage their stock, has been coming down since the early 90s. Manufacturers, on the other hand, are at the highest at any time in 30 years.
Anjani, what's behind that divergence?
So globalization made supply chains more efficient in the 90s because the likes of Toyota popularized just-in-time manufacturing. Retailers drove a harder bargain with suppliers. And since they are closer to customers, they know what customers want, how they're buying, when they're buying, their browsing behavior. And so with relatively limited shelf space in their shops, retailers could demand producers hold more inventory in return for a space on that shelf so that they would never be out of products that were in high demand.
So basically, retailers hold all the power.
Well, yes. Manufacturers hoped that e-commerce would give them more control because they could directly sell to customers and access them rather than having to go through the middlemen, which in theory are the retailers. But shoppers ended up choosing the likes of Amazon and Target and Walmart, kind of a one-stop shop online retailer. So retailers let suppliers dictate prices during the pandemic because they just needed to get products on shelves. But that was a bit of a blip. Now, as artificial intelligence becomes a norm at companies, such technology has meant that retailers have better insights into shoppers' habits. That kind of pressure is now on firms to have supplies delivered on time and in full, which means that suppliers are basically catering to retailers' needs.
So given that pressure and the need to respond to demand as well as supply chain disruption, how do manufacturers ensure that they can deliver on time in full?
So there's essentially two ways, and there are trade-offs. So in one case, they can either create a big base of product and they can manufacture based on forecasts and based on how much they think demand will be, and then cross their fingers and that's that. That obviously has the costs of creating all the stock, which may not end up getting sold. They could, in theory, also build spare production capacity so they could react very quickly without actually having to sit on all this inventory or stock. But either way, manufacturers are the ones that still pick up the tab for any excess production capacity or excess product.
So is there anything they can do to limit their costs?
One common tactic that has become very prevalent among big consumer brands that we all know of is to cut the variety of goods and products. So for example, Hasbro, the maker of toys, has said that it wants to do fewer, better products. Newell Brands, that makes everything from pens to strollers, they too are doing this. Yankee Candle, the maker of candles, now makes candles with 50 less cents. So if you make something that becomes a hot product, you can dictate the terms and the prices. But then hot products also go in and out of favor, as we saw during the pandemic, where users wanted Nintendos and computer screens because they were working from home and everyone was stuck at home. And that makes suppliers vulnerable to consumer demand. And so semiconductor shortages during the pandemic strengthened chipmakers' hand because their end customer, which was, say, the maker of Nintendo or those that made computer screens, needed them immediately. But then they've ended up with a massive glut. So for manufacturers, inventory aches and pains are increasingly a chronic condition.
Anjani, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Sometime during quarantine, it was sometime in 2020, I read the Wikipedia article on Perpetual Stew.
That's Annie Rowerda. She's a writer and social media influencer.
It was in a crock pot. The flavor would change very drastically. There was a time where somebody brought a spice mix and it was really good.
That stew ended up bubbling away for 2 months, and Annie racked up millions of views chronicling its development on TikTok.
Anthony Noonan is a researcher for The Economist.
She even hosted casserole congregations at a park in Brooklyn.
So it started out with me eating stew. I had some of my friends over, and then when I kept it going and posted about it, people were very interested and were like, I want to try it. And I didn't want to have strangers at my house, and so I would carry the stew to a park.
Youngsters would turn up with various vegetables, herbs and spices, as well as flyers. The point of Perpetual Stew, otherwise known as Forever Soup, is very much in the name. The cooking never ceases because ingredients are replenished as required. And if anyone's wondering about food poisoning, I asked Annie about that.
Nobody actually said they got sick.
She said the chances of food poisoning were reduced by making sure that the mixture is piping hot before serving. It's about 74 degrees Celsius that keeps bacteria away from food. So she assured me that the stew was safe to eat. And it's not just Annie. Social media have heralded a revival of interest in the stew.
Anthony, I'm not going to lie, I'm still not sold on this stew. But tell me, where did this recent obsession with it begin?
So the recent obsession began in around 2020 when the food writer Alison Roman published her recipe for a chickpea, coconut and turmeric stew, and it went absolutely viral, earning the moniker The Stew. But stew itself has been going for a very, very long time and has a really varied history.
Tell me a bit about the history of stew.
Well, in medieval Europe, the vast majority of peasants' diets would typically consist of some form of stew. It would be things like pottage, which is a thick, hearty, soupy stew, or pot-au-feu, which is a bit more of a brothy, watery, lighter stew. But most of the time, they would incorporate whatever foods and ingredients they could afford or were reasonably and seasonably available. Perpetual stews, in particular, have record going back quite a way. One of the most famous examples is from Perpignan in France, which was reportedly to have bubbled away since about the 15th century and carried on all the way up until the German invasion of France in the Second World War. They continue to this day, though. There's a really, really famous one in Bangkok at a restaurant called Watana Panid, and it's basically a beef noodle soup that has been cooking for nearly half a century in a massive pan, stands about 5 feet wide, 2.5 feet deep, but loads of social media influencers have gone down to check it out. The very famous Mark Wiens was one of the earlier people to investigate it. And also the travel influencer Wanilla World has recently checked it out on TikTok and has received about 500,000 likes. It's very well celebrated.
Why has it now become so popular?
I think it comes down to a handful of things. One thing I'd say is oddity. There's a lot of novelty there, and I think a lot of people are attracted to it on that front. Another part that I think really draws people in is this real metamorphosing flavour. I guess you could look at it as like a gastronomic ship of Theseus. You start with some things such as starchy elements like potatoes or rice and they give body, and then you add things like celery, carrots, onions, and they bring fragrance and turn it into something a bit lighter. And then you might add something like meat and that gives it depth and gaminess. It's always changing and always developing, and I think that's a real pull for people wanting to get involved with it. And finally, I would say a massive thing is the communality of it. I mean, we have to look back at these old stews and they were bubbled over hearths in the main living areas of homes, and they're a symbol of food's central role in bringing families and neighbours and communities together. We're very much in a more atomised age in the 21st century. Being able to share a meal with neighbours and friends and family is a lot more remote. And I think being able to do that makes it more of a sacred, beautiful act. But that's something I think Annie really tapped into. I think she found that her Gen Z peers really enjoyed the social and collaborative aspects of the Perpetual Stew.
There would be people that would come every single week, the diehards, and stay till the very end. And two of them were single, and now they're dating.
By the time the pot ran dry, Annie estimated she fed around 100 people.
Anthony, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, thank you.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Let us know what you think of the show by emailing us at podcasts@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.